Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the Oscar-winning 1987 Danish film Babbitt's Feast, directed by Gabriel Axel. Returning on the show today to talk about Babbitt's Feast is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this is a great movie, and it's a great... I heard about this before because I was looking up one time about like great food movies, and you look at any list of like great food movies, this ranks at like, if it's not the top, it's like next to it. And I could definitely see why. The food in this movie looks delicious, but I think, you know, the whole, you know, food movies are kind of always a little bit about, you know, like family coming together and something like this. And this, it shares that theme of everybody coming together and just, you know, it's a wholesome movie about how good people can be.
It is, and it also is, it's a great food movie in that it shows you food that's familiar, but it looks very special. Like if you imagine the most sumptuous feast you could ever imagine eating would be some of the things on this menu. I mean, I've never had turtle soup, for example, but I understand there are places you can go where they will prepare Babette's Feast for you. They will make everything on the menu so you can actually taste it all. So, I mean, quails, I mean, these are things that are on menus, but have you ever had a quail? Have you ever eaten quail?
Mm-mm. And actually, in my notes, I wrote down the entire feast. So, bear with me. I'm going to go, it's a little bit long. So, the first course of the meal was turtle soup served with Amontillado sherry. The second part of the meal was buckwheat pancakes with caviar and sour cream served with
Veuve Clicquot.
Thank you.
The nicest champagnes ever.
And then, like you said, you got quail in puff pastry shell with foie gras and truffle sauce served with that same champagne, Pinot Noir. And then you had envy salad. And then you had rum sponge cake with fibs and candy sherry served with champagne. Assorted cheese. And then the final course, no, the second to last course was assorted cheeses and fruits served with sautines. And then the very last one was coffee with Vieuxmarque Champagne Cognac. Just wow! Just, that's just a mouthful saying it. I can't imagine it's going to be a huge mouthful when you're eating it.
Well, you know, and it also there was a drink. Some sort of special wine to go with all seven courses. So obviously, by the time they got to the end of the meal, they were feeling pretty good.
And you know, when you think about if people haven't seen this movie and we describe this just giant list of food, you're thinking, well, that just seems extravagant, people just gorging themselves on all this food. When you realize the story, this entire food is sort of just a reward for the selflessness of these two sisters, and just not only what they've done for Babbitt, the secondary character, for her and her life, but just what they've done for everybody and just their dedication just to helping everybody. It's sort of like their reward for all the good they've done.
Yeah, it also shows that they gave things up to live the life that they had. You know, they were very involved in their church. Both of these spinster ladies had chances at love with people who happened to be visiting, and they decided, no, they were going to give that up to stay with their father and, you know, help him with his congregation. That's kind of what Babette does. She shows up, you know, out of nowhere with a letter saying, you know, this is somebody they know will vouch for her. And they take her in even though they can't afford to pay her, and she becomes their maid. She also has given something up, and she has resigned herself. Well, this is going to be my life. I'm going to live in this, you know, windswept area, and it's sort of an exile. So all three ladies have a self-imposed exile. I think one of the things that makes Babette's Feast feel so victorious in the end is not only does everyone sort of lay down their petty differences at the table, but the fact that she shows them, well, you know, sometimes you get another chance. And what do you do with it? And what she does with it is something that they would have done, something very giving and selfless.
Yeah, and interesting to talk about second chances because one of the guests at this dinner was an old general who passed by a long time ago when he was young and the girls were young, and he was interested in one of them, but he left before he could really pursue that. And it seems at the end he tries to rekindle that relationship with her. So do you think like maybe that they're going to finally be together at the end? Or
I like to think so because I always want a happy ending. But he also provides the worldly voice, you know, the only person at the table who's really been out and seen the world, and he's the one who recognizes all the food as coming from this amazing restaurant he remembers from Paris. Well, he doesn't know that Babette was the chef there. He just recognizes the amazing food. So he's the one who is, since everyone's agreed not to talk about the food because it might be too sinful, he's the only one who comes in as an outsider and is talking about what, oh my God, this champagne is from this. And this is, oh, wow, I haven't tasted this since I was at that amazing restaurant. He's the one who sort of narrates for everybody what amazing stuff they are ingesting and why they should be amazed.
Mm-hmm. And it is, like you said, we do learn of Babette's sacrifice, because not only because the whole story is, spoiler alert a little bit, she wins the the only connection she has left to France, because she's in exile there during one of the revolutions, is that she has a lottery ticket that, you know, she submits, and she doesn't think any of it. One day, of course, she wins a big ton of money, and instead of, you think like she's just going to do this little feast of the farewell and then she's going to go back home, but then she realized she spent all of this money for this feast to prepare for it. She spent every last cent. And then you also figure out that, like you said, with the guy who's complaining, like, this was like that great restaurant I had. You figure out she was the head chef there. Just realize that, once again, she is sacrificing everything just to show, or to show her appreciation for the sisters and what they've done to her. But also, it's almost, I was wondering, do you feel like she just feels like it's home for her now? That it'd just be weird to go back to France with no connections, and she's had this lasting connection for years with these two sisters?
I think that the implication is that she could have used that money and gone back to her old life. And that's what she decided she wasn't going to do. She was actually going to use the money to say thank you instead and stay where she is, which is what the other two ladies did as well. They gave up a chance at another life and love when they were young and they had, you know, the beauty to attract the men who showed up in the first place. Mm-hmm. But they also gave up the best of what they had of themselves and stayed where they were.
Yeah, because even one of the scenes with the opera singers teaching her how to sing, and it's all just so he can pursue her romantically and everything.
Yes.
And then when, you know, and she can tell she feels uncomfortable, and then when she's at the dinner, she's like, oh, I'm fine. I don't want any lessons anymore, because it's almost like she's just afraid to do it, or she just doesn't want to do it anymore. She's just more comfortable doing what she's, you know, working with the church.
And how show-offy is that, you know, as a contrast, you know, the contrast between, you know, being a very pious, reflective person and somebody who sings opera and gets up on a stage. I mean, it's very... Mm-hmm. It's a real difference of lives. She could have seen the world. She could have been famous. She could have had a family. She could have done all these things, but only at the expense of not appreciating what she had.
Mm-hmm. Leaving home behind may have been too much or something like that.
So getting back to what you were saying, I think for Babette, she wasn't going to go back to her old life. She wasn't going to, that was never, I think, a consideration for her. I think in a way, using what she had as a gift was a way to show the sisters that she learned something from them.
That's a good point. And like you said, like, I think it was at the time, like, who else does she know in France anymore? This wasn't like she, like it was before she came here. It's like, now there's nobody else. Like, do I go in a place I haven't been for years with a bunch of strangers, or stay here where I'm always welcome and people care for me and respect me and all that stuff?
And who saved my life? Mm-hmm. Who took me in when I had nobody?
Mm-hmm. And so just all this stuff about positive, and when we talk about our next film, it's going to be a completely different tone, but it's just, you know, it almost feels like it's interesting that the Pope, Francis, he said that this was his all-time favorite movie, and this film does have a bit of you feel that this film has like a religious, it almost feels like a religious experience, is because the food is so good. It almost feels like a religion of like people coming together and putting aside their petty differences. Like, you see all these old people were saying, "Well, you did this to me. You cheated me out of this deal when, you know, 30 years back and everything." But the food is so good. It's almost a way of like saying, "Forget it," you know.
We all can come together when we break bread together, kind of thing. Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. But I think also it's the reason that it's a good film for people who want to see it from a religious standpoint is that it's about generosity. And of course, let's not discount all the drinking that's happening at the table. But they do. Everyone comes to the table very, you know, with their own troubles and anxieties, angers, old petty grievances, whatever. And by the time the meal's over, they've let that go.
Because the food is so good. And it's interesting because they're afraid because all this extravagance, like, oh, is it a sin or vanity mm-hmm. or something? They say, well, we can't compliment on it. But then the food is so good and just makes them feel so happy that they have almost like they have to compliment it at the end. And they sort of break down that, you know, that little thing that they were going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it all works out. In mm-hmm. the end, everybody has a really good meal. And, you know, then there's the whole Last Supper aspect of it. I mean, if you really want to go into the religious.
Yeah, religious. Yeah. And it was interesting. The movie itself, what I like about this film is there's no, like, huge conflict in the movie, you know, besides maybe the whole, well, we can't like, say anything or compliment the taste of the food. There's no, like, you know, it's not like she tries to get the food, but it breaks down or somebody steals it. Like, you know, if this was, like, a Hollywood movie, they would try to have something like that or even make it comedic, like, you know, oh, I burnt the bread, or the
general would say, you know, I happen to know that there's an opening at Cafe Anglais. Mm-hmm. What serendipity that I met you tonight. That's how they would have done it in Hollywood.
And I think, but that's what's so good about it. It doesn't need to have that huge conflict or something to be entertaining and watchable. That's what I really liked about it. They didn't try to manufacture something.
Well, it's based on a novella. And Isaac Dennison is always, she writes like that, you know, sort of slice of life, ordinary situations, rather than relying on, you know, mm-hmm. and Hollywood style techniques.
It actually leads into my next question. So you said Isaac Dennison? Mm-hmm. Is there, she have like a pen name called Karen Blixen.
Okay, yes, because I wrote that. Her real name is Isaac Dennison, but she was Karen Blixen when she married Mr. Blixen.
Okay.
Which you can see the whole thing play out in Out of Africa,
which she
also wrote. And, you know, she's lucky enough to have Meryl Streep playing her. Hmm. But, yeah, her name was Isaac Dennison, but most people know her as Karen Blixen.
So have you read this story?
Yes, I use it in when we have the study abroad that goes to Denmark. We read the short story and we compare it with the movie.
And so we'll talk a little bit about the performances in the movie. So Babette is actually a French actress, and her name is Stéphane Audran. And I know she's a big star. I looked at her work. She's done quite a few films with Louis Buñuel. So I was wondering if you could comment on anything about, you know, I really liked her performance. And I thought she was probably my favorite character of the movie. And we'll just maybe comment about that and maybe a bit of her career.
Well, I haven't seen the other things that she has made, but... I think she did a great job with the role, which they first offered to Catherine Deneuve. Mm. And she had already been criticized for taking on roles that were, you know, maybe a little too complex for what they wanted Catherine Deneuve to do. So she turned it down. And this French actress used to be married to Claude Chabrol. Axel asked Chabrol, you know, whether he thought that she would be suitable. And he said she was the archetype of Babette. And he gave the script to her, told her Deneuve was contemplating the role, and asked her if she could respond before the next day. And she called 2 hours later and said, I want that role. And then the following day, Deneuve declined, and she was officially cast. So I think she does a good job of being the quiet, the person who shows up, who ends up on your doorstep, and you don't know who they are, but they're sort of mysterious. Mm-hmm. And you don't know if they're... You know, these ladies are very, the home she comes to is very religious, so they don't know if she's some sort of bad omen. It takes a while for the town people to even welcome her. Cool. And she has this sort of elegance mm-hmm. about her that when you find out that she used to be this famous chef, you think, of course, it makes perfect mm-hmm. sense.
You talk about the bad omen. One of the most interesting sequences in the film is when they have the two sisters have this dream about the food, and it's very like hallucination like, and she's like giving them a glass of wine, and it's very creepy. And that was an interesting little like dream sequence in this movie. And like, one of the creepiest things in this movie is when she's bringing all this huge food, and then you see the turtle, and the giant turtle, and I'm pretty sure this was like fake, but the turtle just looks at him and goes like that'll give you nightmares.
Right. Someone spoke back. Yes, or something. Now, the actress who plays Philippa is Bodil Kjær. I don't know if I'm saying her name right. But she's considered the first lady of Danish theater and the namesake of the Bodil Award. There's actually kind of a lot of famous Scandinavian actors in this movie. The guy who plays the general, Jarl Kule, and the Swedish court lady is Bibi Andersson. They're both favorites of Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah. And then the other actress who played the other sister, I probably mispronounced her name, Birgit Federspiel. I know that's horrible, but...
Birgit Federspiel. She was also very, very good. I haven't seen her in other things, though.
And one other character I want to comment. I really like the server boy in the movie. Mm-hmm. I thought he was funny, just how the... that's something
always
I
trying
would,
to sneak the liquor.
Yeah,
yep.
I would totally do that as a kid. You know, when nobody's looking, I would pour myself a little glass of wine, and it's so funny because we can all connect to that as kids. We always want a little taste of beer or
yeah,
wine.
Yeah, and you also kind of see it coming.
And so the film has been a huge hit. It won Academy Award for Best Foreign Film of the Year, and it's considered a classic. And I got to say, I agree with this. And this is definitely one of the films that. If you want to like look at foreign movies or especially Denmark movies, I mean, you have to do this one.
Oh, you have to do this one, yeah, because it's so well known. The director, though, even though he's done a lot of stuff, he's actually a really interesting was an interesting person. He started off as a cabinet maker, and then he was a stage actor.
Interesting.
And he made lots and lots of other movies, including Prince of Jutland in 1994. Which is about the legend of Prince Amleth, with Helen Mirren, Gabriel Byrne, and Christian Bale. But it really didn't do that much. Most of the other things that he's done have not come anywhere near to what he achieved with Babette's Feast. But he worked on it like in the back of his mind for 15 years. It was his dream project. Hmm. So maybe it was his feast. You know, maybe that was him.
Interesting. And so have you seen other films? Because I was looking around, nothing really stood out. One other film came out in the 60s. I think it was positively reviewed at Cannes Film Festival or something. It was called The Red Mantle. Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen that one.
Okay. Yeah, let me see. So we could talk a little bit about, this is probably the first film we've talked about with Denmark movies. So tell us a little bit more about the film history of Denmark. I know when we're going to do our next show, we'll talk a little bit more about other films, but... To talk about maybe some, if like a 101 guide, maybe give us some like other films you would essentially recommend.
Well, this one's sort of an outlier because it has a director that, you know, when I talk about him in class, there's not lots of other things to say except that, well, he actually did make this movie with Helen Mirren, but it didn't do really well. So this is a flagship movie, but not necessarily a great example of Danish filmmaking, except for the fact that they deliberately chose the location, because in the novella, it's actually taking place in Norway. But that's the real place was too pretty.
Interesting.
And they wanted something a little more windswept and looking more desolate, like someplace you would feel like you had been exiled, especially if you had just come from Paris, where you were on the top of the world. So there's that contrast.
Yeah, it was an interesting location in this movie, just because, like you said, it is so isolated. It's just this tiny little town. It doesn't look like more than like 100 people live there. And you're way out in the rocks, and there's just the sea over there. So it just seems like there's no way you can have any other outside contact with civilization.
The church used in the movie was Merup Church in Jutland, built around 1250. And it's on this geologically unique cliff, which you think about when you think about the scenery from the movie. And it kept edging towards the sea as the ground eroded. So between 2007 and 2016, the church was dismantled and moved to a new site on an open-air national museum.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but that whole area was just kind of meant to look, really desolate. That was the reason for the changing, actually, the country as well as the space. But Danish movies are most notable for the ones that adhere to the briefly lived dogma rules.
Which we will definitely talk about next.
And
Lars von Trier, Danish, okay. I was wondering, that's another one we'll be talking about, so I guess I'll save that for later. But one Danish director I know who's made a career in America is Nicholas Winding Refn. And I did one of the films he did back in Denmark was a film, was called Valhalla Rising with Mads Mikkelsen.
Yes, Mads Mikkelsen.
And that's just one of those movies where you're just like, I don't get it. And then he's kind of like that. Like, I watched Only God Forgives, and that was, what? You know? I did like Drive, which Drive and Bronson is most Hollywood movies because they got Tom Hardy and Ryan Gosling, and those are really good movies. But it's just these other films, like I still haven't seen Neon Demon, but after hearing what other people say about it and all the weird stuff that's in it, I might be like, I might want to take a pass on that.
Yeah, there's some, I think some of the Danish Dogma directors are better than others. Not terribly familiar with that one.
Reffin, okay. So we could save a little bit more, but Lars von Trier, I know he's sort of a guy, he's also done things here in America. He's sort of a guy that seems to me, it's like he always likes to push boundaries a bit. He likes to be very shocking. Like one of the things was in that movie, the Nymphomaniac movies, mm-hmm. he was showing everything.
Everything.
And yeah. So
and
it just,
the Antichrist movie.
Oh, yeah. And I figured there's like actual stuff going on
Well,
there.
Just some weird, weird stuff. I don't know how he talks Charlotte Gainsbourg into these movies. But yeah, really, really out there. He likes mm-hmm. to push buttons. And when we talk about Dogville, you know, we can talk about the fact that that's not really a Danish movie, but boy, does it feel like a Danish movie. But it also sort of feels like our town gone really bad.
Is that the movie where it's like this outline of a town?
Yes.
But it's like not really a town. It's like in a, like a building or something?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard
that. Very stagey, but it works.
So do you feel that, you know, when he does all these boundary pushings, like showing, you know, a lot of films have actual sex on camera and stuff. Do you feel that it works or do you feel that it's just more shocking for shocking's sake?
I think it's a little of both. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a provocateur, but kind of like Tarantino is. Although instead of being violent, he goes for the sex or the weird stuff or the supernatural or the occult. He presses a different kind of boundary. But it's very mm-hmm. Tarantino-esque, don't you think? Very, look at me.
Show off. Yeah. It's interesting because there's always like saying, I'm like, for stuff like that, it's sort of like, there's always a like, stuff for me that's like, okay, that's a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. Just some directors like that, like, that's a little bit too much for me.
And yet, after a movie like Dogville, you find yourself thinking about it for days. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is something that he does that's, you know, right past the point where you feel comfortable. But, you know, that's kind of maybe where his genius lies.
Mm-hmm. And it was interesting. We'll talk about this more when we do The Boss of It All. But it wasn't like The Boss of It All was a bit more constrained and not as show off. He felt more just like a goofy comedy.
Goofy comedy, but the sex scenes that are in there are not the way they would have done them in the U.S.
Oh, definitely not.
There's something very trashy
yeah.
about it, which is kind of what makes it seem more real and not like an American movie.
Mm-hmm. So I'm getting close to the end of my questions here. So, is there anything else about either Danish films or Babbitt's Feast that you want to bring up?
Well, you know, usually when I talk about Danish film in class, I try to talk a little bit about Scandinavian film in general. And, of course, the Swedish films and Ingmar Bergman, and especially The Seventh Seal. And usually, if you look at, like, the standard canon of what everybody talks about in world cinema, you have to talk about The Seventh Seal. There's no way to not talk about The Seventh Seal. And it's beautifully shot. I mean, you know, the blacks are really, really dark. Mm-hmm. The whites are super crisp and very, it's beautiful to look at. You can freeze frame anywhere and just think, look at that composition. It's just gorgeous. But it's so old fashioned. And I stopped using it in class after a couple of semesters because I was giving my students the idea that nothing had happened in Scandinavian film since the 50s, which is not true. Mm-hmm. And there have been, Babette's Feast was the first Danish film to win an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, but Suzanne Beer and other people have come along and have gotten more contemporary awards. And so I try to reference the past, but then talk about what's being done currently, because some of the stuff that they're doing is pretty avant-garde.
Mm-hmm. It was funny you could talk about Seventh Seal. I actually did this on my show. Of all people, it was my my employee, Matt Trudell. I made him watch it on a bet, figuring that he would hate the movie because it's a foreign film in black and white with subtitles. He would just go crazy. He actually ended up really liking the film. We had a good discussion about it. It's pretty funny. Okay, then. So you talked a little bit earlier. So just last question I'll have for you is just tell us a little bit about how you bring this film into your class and how you discuss it with your students.
This one I use specifically when I do the study abroad Denmark, because when we are in Denmark, we go see Isaac Dinesen's house. Because after she came back from Africa and her marriage broke up, she went back to her childhood home. So you can walk through her house and see some of her old manuscripts and stuff, and it's at a beautiful area of Denmark right on the water. You can see the water from her front steps. It's just really beautiful. So in order to expose the students to who she was and bring in the literature, we read Babette's Feast, the short story, and something from Out of Africa and Shadows on the Grass, and then they watch those two films. That way they have a little bit of a introduction to Isaac Dinesen before we even get there. And then when we're in her house, it sort of brings it into full circle.
So when you screen the movie for your students, Babette's Feast, wow, did they like it? Or what was the overall reaction to it?
You know, they think they're not going to like it because it's an older film and it's about something very serious like religion. and then they end up feeling, in the end, they identify with Babette.
I bet they're hungry at the end.
Yes, this is not a film to eat when you were hungry and home alone with no food and no money and no car.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director Gabriel Axel and his 1987 classic Babette's Feast. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Preston Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying an artist is never poor.